House Committee on Land Use for Thursday, February 19th, 2009, and open a work session on House Bill 2009. Colleagues, once again, we're meeting in a work session type setting. Representative Garrett has proposed what I think is actually a pretty smart way of dividing up the different aspects so that we can spend some time in a couple of sessions talking about them. And I'm going to ask Representative Garrett to kind of preside over the conversation, although I think last time on Tuesday when we met, it was a pretty productive way of meeting, and so it'll be a little less formal and not a lot of calling on people unless it gets unless people are talking on top of each other. The fundamental question for each of the aspects of the bill that I think you have in front of you by section is, first question for the committee, is there a critical mass of members of the committee who think that that subject, maybe not the exact words that are in the bill, but that subject is worth grappling with and including in the final bill in some form or another? If we find out that there's only one of us who thinks that it's a critical enough item, and I know at least one of these items where I may be the only one on the committee who thinks it's important, but that's okay.
You got a gavel.
A gavel has only so much use, Representative Clem. So the first question is this an issue we want to put some effort into finding useful language for? And if the answer is no, then I think we set it aside and spend time where we do think there's productive. And then the second question, obviously, is what should this bill accomplish in that area? And we're not here to draft LC language, but our good vice chair is going to, and administrator together, will take notes from what we have here and benefit from written testimony that's already been received by the committee to take a stab at working with LC to draft something that seems to capture the sense of the committee, understanding that on some of these we will not have absolute consensus among committee members on where we should go, and therefore what they draft will not have unanimous support. But the extent to which we can aim for broad support, even unanimous support, that should be something we start with trying to do. And then, as you see here, a few days into the future, with a target to having our work on this bill completed, wrapped up, and a product sent out of this committee, either to Ways and Means, which is its current next step, or to the floor if we determine that there is no fiscal impact on what we leave in the bill. So either of those paths is an option, but we should be done with our work by second week of March. So with that, Representative Garrett, do you want to start the conversation off about sections 1-3?
Sure. Well, colleagues, as you can see, this is an outline for how we might go about this over the next few weeks. I structured it this way really for no other reason than I think there are some sections of the bill where we may need more time to be prepared to discuss them. There are organizations have come forward with some conceptual changes to sections of the bill on reclassification of land, state planning. Those, I think, are going to be important conversations. Those will be coming later on this schedule to give us more time to get ready to do it. So that would leave for today, starting with some of the more discrete and sections that I think we can talk about without a lot of documents in front of us. And so those would be first sections 1-3 of the bill, which are the sections talking about the four principles recommended by the Big Look Task Force to guide land use planning in Oregon. Second, section 17, dealing with annexation. And third for today would be Section 18, which is the recommendation to have the department appoint a work group to study ways to reduce complexity in the system. Those are three very different recommendations, but I think recommendations that we can probably deal with over the next couple hours. So that's where I would suggest we start.
All right. Principals. As we all know, the task force recommended some overarching principles to frame the purpose or the overall vision or parameters within which the land use program within Oregon works. So thoughts on whether we think the idea of having such an overarching perspective adds value to the land use program, independent of whether you think those particular words that they've recommended are the right ones. But is there value to that? So is it worth, well, that would be retain it as is, keep it but modify it, or delete it. Not a final decision, but...
Well, I hear Esquivel before
yeah.
I say
a word. Yeah, that's right. He's waiting for the cue in on me, Madam Chair.
Representative.
I think we have to have something that's a guideline, that's an overview of this whole thing. I'm not sure that this is pretty detailed. Again, I get back to the KISS system. And we always deviate from the KISS system. We always get complex. In fact, today, to give you a good example, and this is kind of the same way, is we had for workforce development a way to make it easier, and we brought out this great big chart with all this elaborate things that we as a government do in order to get the money to one place. And I mean, it was where you could not understand it. Then we brought out another chart that was just kind of a straight-through shot with the governor in charge. Well, I'm not proposing that the governor be in charge of this, but I am proposing that I think you could make it much more simpler than start getting into detail exactly what we're talking about, because we all, I think it's a foregone conclusion that we know what our assets are, we know what we want to preserve, we know what we want to retain, and we know what this state, in our own minds, wants. We all know what we want it to look like. And we don't want it to look like, and excuse the expression, but a city that is grown out to the point of where all you see is city. I don't want it to look like Tokyo, where you stand on a 40-story building and all you see is buildings. I don't want that. But I do want it to be able to grow, but to grow in a manner of which local people have an option to make it grow the way they want it to grow, because they know their city better than anyone. So,
Representative Cowan?
I'll let you actually. Thank you. Actually, sections 1 through 3, I like as well as I like any part of the bill. And I think it's important as we've listened to a lot of testimony and we've thought about things that have been said, and we can't go away from our goals, and these guiding principles can't take the place of, and the things of that nature that we've heard in various pieces of testimony. I think it's important to look at what it says. There is no suggestion, at least none that I've read, in section 1 through 3 that suggests that we move away from the kinds of the current goals, statewide goals that we have in place. It simply suggests that the comprehensive plans be not only expressions of public policy, basis for more specific rules, consistent and coordinated, regularly reviewed, some of those kinds of things, but that the principles of what Oregonians are looking for are sort of outlined here in terms of a healthy environment, a sustainable, prosperous economy, a quality of life, and fairness and equity. And those are pretty hard goals to argue with. I mean, on the other hand, it might be wise if we all kept some of those kinds of things in mind as we tried to make rules and made sure that they fit. I like the fact that really the only addition to existing law in Section 2 is that we consider the variation in conditions and needs in different regions of the state. I think I might have said that once or twice in my conversation. And then Section 3 simply goes on to mention once again that these four principles be considered when we're designing the goals. So I find honestly little to argue with in Sections 1 and 3.
She wants me to call on people. Representative Klum.
That's her. I just look.
So, I mean, the thing is, land use law, you start getting into the three different ways that you can do a destination resort. The goal way, the pre, you know, 85 way, the statutory way. I don't want another way that is somehow embedded in the mix of legal, and this is when we get to complexity, you know, another, and I know it's said it's not designed to do that, that we're not going to have another thing to sue on to say, well, no, you didn't meet principle three, but, so then why do you have them? Is it because we think all Oregonians actually read the statutes and say, oh, yeah, our land use system has that? Well, no. So do we stick it on glossy flyers that say these are the principles of our land use system? Maybe. But you actually got to have all those ongoing town hall meetings, you know, Project Foresight 1973 meetings to have it on a flyer. So that's my one problem with even with doing it, is I don't want it to be a new place to litigate on, and I want it to actually be useful to an average Oregonian who's trying to think about this stuff. And so if we think it will be, okay, let's work on language. If, you know, if not, I don't know.
Just being candid.
I don't think they're intended to give litigants any new ammunition.
No offense to the trial lawyers.
And the way they're worded, I don't see how they could. I mean, I don't see how anybody could win a lawsuit with reference to the standard of sustaining a prosperous economy or ensuring a desirable quality of life. And I hear what you're saying. We don't want them to have any the kind of teeth that could lead to affecting litigation. The flip side is, if we don't want them to have teeth, why are they there? And I can only conclude that the purpose was to give the department in rulemaking some additional direction about, to the extent they aren't already thinking about these things, we want to make sure they really are thinking about these things.
I think there's one thing and Representative Cowan kind of touched on it, is to get public input, It really doesn't do us much good to get public input if we go down, listen, then go back and say, okay, this is what we're going to do, and this is what our rules are, period, and this is what you will do. I've been involved with that many, many times. I don't know, I'm sure you made, well, I'm not sure you have been, but I know that we've had the goalposts move on us before in the past. You think you have an agreement, you think you have an understanding, and then you get something completely different. It's very frustrating. Very frustrating to me as for as application to my particular county and my particular region, to have people that say one thing and then change the rules halfway through it. And I'm alluding to something that in the future that we will discuss. So, but it's very, very frustrating. And if you're going to listen to the public, then listen to the public and put down what they want in their particular region, not what you think they should have. Providing they go within the goals. I need to add that caveat.
Can we probe just a little bit more of our two former local government folks? Each of you have, I think, in your local government roles, had to deal with local land use decisions of some kind. Can you think of an instance where you would have made a different decision than you did if you had had these guiding principles to follow? Does it, what I'm trying to get at is, does it help you make decisions
No.
No.
I think the simple answer to that question is, would this have helped me in making a land use decision because it was written in statute in this way? No. I think that these are kinds of guiding principles that most of us in public service take very seriously anyway, whether they're written down on paper or not. Where I see them as being somewhat useful and certainly not harmful is, that's the reason I went back to, they are guiding principles for development of the comprehensive plan, not making land use decisions. And the reason that's a critical difference is because within the comprehensive land use plan, then you have those, I think it's currently 19 goals, and everybody references, does this meet goal 4, does this meet goal 3, does this meet goal 19, in terms of those overarching things that you have to maintain. I see these as principles more to keep in mind as we look at those existing goals, decide whether they continue to be important, should they be adapted along the way or something of that nature. I don't see this as the sort of thing that you would step back and use to make a land use decision. The more challenging part of land use decision making is that it's because it's an appeal process as you work through local government. You start with your department, the department says yes or no, you take it to the planning commission and it requires some sort of an exception. They say yes or no. If that's not a satisfactory decision on the part of one or the other party, then it gets appealed up the line to the next level of government. And at that point, you really have before you, here are the guiding principles that apply to this particular situation, and your decision-making is based on, are you meeting this particular piece of the law or not? It may not be the decision that I would particularly think on a basis of common sense and what makes sense, should this building be here, should it not be there, it may not. The decision I have to make as a local official may be different than what my, for lack of a better way to say it, gut instinct tells me should probably happen on this particular piece of land because it has to meet these particular guiding points. The word I'm looking for is escaping me, but then I have to do a set of findings that essentially justify my decision because it did or didn't meet these specific
criteria.
Points. Criteria, whatever the word, I know there's a word that's better than that, but it doesn't want to run through my brain at this moment.
And Representative Cowan brings up a great point because being part of an appeal process, and that's really the only time, I don't know about county commissioners in your county, but it's the only time that your councils are involved really in land use is ordinances that pertain to land use and or from an appeal process. But in an appeal process, you always have, and I think this is correct, Representative, you always have either a statute or an AR rule that kind of dictates what you're going to have your outcome. If you violate it, then you have a problem. If you don't, then you comply with it. That's kind of the way I've interpreted that. There isn't much latitude in an appeal process. It's an interpretation. You can get into those, but that gets a little sticky. Usually your attorney will advise you on what cases have happened in the state and will guide you through that process. But that's really the only time that you do that. What is interesting to me is that I came from a local government that was a city. You came from a county, and those are actually a little two different worlds because of the different types of planning that you do in a county versus what you do in a city. A city is completely different. But we still have the same rules to go by. So I understand what you're saying, but I've always felt that when I went into a land use hearing on an appeal, that usually the law was defined to me before I ever went in.
they're different in the sense of the kind of uses that you put into traditionally within city boundary areas that a city council would have governance, over which a city council would have governance, as opposed to the unincorporated areas of a county over which county has governance. But we're both working with the same set of land use laws. It's just that I have different, as a county commissioner, I had different zoning than yours that was primarily residential or
commercial retail.
Commercial retail kind of uses. So different pieces of the law applied. But it isn't that unlike my limited knowledge of a court structure where this is the law. The decision that's being made in any courtroom is, did one violate the law or did they not? The decisions that are being made at county government or city government in a land use appeal is, does what you want to do meet the letter of the law within what is the structure for this particular zone, or as an accepted, usually it's an acceptable conditional use. Can you meet the criteria to be able to qualify for the exception that you're asking for? So what we're talking about from this perspective is, how do we come up with appropriate statewide land use law that sets those, what can you or can't you do in whatever the given zone is, and then gets interpreted as we move through those processes.
We probably weren't much help, were we?
Did you have comments?
Yeah, I... I hope the purpose of improving 229 is to provide guidance for where the land use system, how it emerges over the next 20 years, say. It seems to me that's a really worthwhile goal. That's what we put the big look in place for. And I think, and that's big a task, I think you always need to go back to first principles and ask, what are we trying to do? And I've been very impressed with those four elements as they basically describe the first principles that we want our land use system to be. Now, they're not, in their application, they're sometimes contradictory, they're not all complementary, they're not mutually exclusive, but they are all elements that all of us want to see in the land use system. So I start with saying, okay, we have these first principles. We have 19 goals, and there are some new ones proposed, I understand, though it could go to 21 or 22 pretty soon. Those are really contradictory. So what I could hope we do is to ask ourselves, how do those 19 goals, which of those 19 goals relate to these overarching principles? And, for example, goal one, citizen participation, goes to the fairness goal, I think. I mean, you can easily see that. So it seems to me the next step ought to be to categorize those 19 goals in this, and then to ask, how is the land use systems, how does it need to be changed? We're going to talk about inventory, some of these things. How does it need to be changed in order to move it closer as we go forward to what we all desire in these principles? And I think, in essence, if we inventory components of the land use system, I think we'll see areas where we need to be changing. I think we have clues to it in the Big Look report. I think they gave us some clues in areas. They didn't quite come to the conclusions on how to do it or achieve consensus, but there are ways that would guide us in both in what we put into 229 and what's in the downstream step after that. So I think if as an objective we want to move the land use system in a way that maximizes the combination of those four elements, and we use that in our analysis to guide us as to where to go, it seems to me they're very useful principles. And I would say I think it's a good place to start. Now, the fact is local government deals both in the legislative and the quasi-judicial side, and those are sort of different behaviors. I don't think these principles necessarily guide in the quasi-judicial, where essentially you're deciding, does this exemption meet the law? But I think you are guided by these when you create a comprehensive plan, for example, which
which is the sort of legislative kind of functions that that ought to be guided with these, and we ought to help make clear how these ought to guide you as you're beginning. So I think it's more than boilerplate to establish a first principles. If we all agree as we move forward that if we could achieve these objectives in a land use system, we would all be pleased with that land use system. I think basically deep down, if we could create a land use system that did fairness, economic growth, a pleasing environment, these kinds of things, I think the system would be way ahead. So I think we ought to really consider keeping and using them as we move forward.
I just want to confirm, and that's my understanding too, I don't think these would be workable in a quasi-judicial setting, but as I read the bill, they would come into play in two ways. One is for the department in rulemaking and goal making, in preparing, adopting, and amending goals and guidelines. That's section 3. The second way they come into play is that we instruct in section 1 that these four principles provide guidance to a public body that adopts or interprets goals, comprehensive plans, and land use regulations implementing the plans, or administrative rules implementing the statutes. So I think it's purely in a legislative capacity that these are factors.
Briefly,
sure.
I think the challenge in the interpretation of this is that for local government at both the city and the county role, we play several roles. And I think we've focused a little, maybe too much, on the quasi-judicial role that is part of being a local government. We also play a legislative role in developing things when we're helping with the development or revisions of the comprehensive plan. So I think we may have gotten our thinking off track a little bit, and I just wanted to kind of clarify that, because certainly is that role for local government as well.
When you pass your land ordinance as well as your ordinances within your community, you also that comes into play.
That's true. That's a legislative role for local
government.
I don't know who to ask this question of.
Weird. I don't know the question.
Would we interpret these goals as a complete list? In other words, Mr. Rindy, I'm looking at you. I don't see anyone else from the department here. If a local government wanted to do, well, if LCDC, I don't know if they're one of those public bodies defined here, but let's just say a city wanted to do something that someone said didn't fit within one of these guiding principles but was consistent with one of the statewide land use goals, would this language prohibit them from doing it because it's not on the list?
I see a big look member saying no.
I can't imagine that it would.
So it's not an exhaustive list?
Shouldn't.
In other words, could there be other guiding principles?
Principle action, I think, is what we're
Do we think this is a complete enough list?
Comprehensive. Is this the whole list?
Right. Or do we want to say, this is helpful, but you do not have to squeeze under one of these principles in order to act, as long as what you're doing fits within other statute? If that's the way we understand it, then I think the conversation is on point.
That's not how I would imagine it being used. I would imagine it being used rather to say, as we deal with these decisions, how can we bring the decisions to maximize one or the other or all of them? I can't imagine a decision that's not going to somehow affect fairness or the economy or the environment. I'm forgetting the fourth.
Quality of life.
Desirable quality of life. Yeah. I can't imagine how something's not going to positively, and I guess many things might positively affect one and negatively affect another, and you're trying to weigh them and balance them. But
let me ask a question for, I think, probably Representative Escobar. Actually, maybe Representative Hanley, because you were on a city council, right? So you might have been too lost in the weeds. Let me ask Representative Hanley. You know, in terms of local communities and people who live there who don't necessarily think that land use planning is critical because they don't have the same growth pressures as, you know, you get up here. Goals that Salem makes and puts in the statute, is that going to further agitate? I mean, do they make their own goals, but then if they're not helpful or binding or they don't give any new tools, does that do anything for them?
Well, you know, one of the things talking about local control is that if you come to a very rural area and compare a very slow growth area to an area of incredible growth, and you could use in Oregon a number of regions that have had, you know, in recent past explosive growth, Bend, Redmond, different parts of the Portland area, even parts of Medford, Ashland in pockets. You know, compare that to an annual growth rate in Douglas County of 1.8 or something. Probably the measurement of sustaining a prosperous economy is different when you say that rural part of the state who is having little to no growth might have weighted their economical, the economy part of their growth to how can we build the economy?
Yeah.
Not so much around we're running out of space to stack houses. So I think that's where we hit against some of the, you know, differences, and that even these overarching principles may knock heads in different areas of the state, because if you're in a very low growth area, you're hoping for some moderate growth.
I think they'd be weighted differently.
They'd be weighted point. Differently, and I think that's probably the key issue.
That actually may tell us how regional variation relates as to how these different goals would be weighted. Whereas in some places, developing economic growth would be high, in other places, so much of what we heard in Measure 37 had to do with equity. Lots and lots of equity issues.
We're still trying to figure out whether we actually want to engage on this, and we've been engaging for quite a while, I know.
So I'm actually hearing pretty clear consensus among the committee members that these sections have value and that they ought to be retained in a bill that we would want to pass along. So then the question is, these exact words, or do people want to offer, either for a conversation here or in writing, some alternatives to them?
Well, I would suggest that the principles seem pretty good to me. The words may relate to how they're used, and maybe in later sections that talk about what to do with the principles. I mean, I was sort of surprised in the language that said, well, you don't really need to take them into consideration most of the time, just sometimes. And that seemed a little interesting. So. But they, as principles, they look very good to me.
Yeah. The fact that I feel like at some level thousands of hours were spent listening to things, and the Big Look Task Force thought they were in, I'm sure there's a better reason than I've articulated. Maybe I didn't listen exactly. I'm going to grab Ken outside. We'll talk a lot more about this, I'm sure. But I assume there's a pretty well thought out theory behind it. So even though I kind of wonder about it, because a statewide list that nobody locally could change the words in it once we put it in there. And if we made it a local list, they all made, and it's got no ability to actually translate into different decisions anywhere, I wonder, but I assume there's a good reason. So I say we go forward. I'm going to start talking to the task force members again about what exactly they hope to see it accomplished and see if I can get myself to get you a list.
Let's take yes for an answer.
All right.
Well, since nobody else will, I'll provide a dissenting voice on this. I'm not sure, I know we've been talking about it now for 40 minutes, but I'm not sure that, I think the point's already been made, that I don't think this really gets us anywhere. I don't see the forward movement in adding this language. I think I've debated whether or not to say that if this were soup, it would have no taste, or to try to categorize it some other way, but I think that the language just attempts to be all things to all people, which is fine, but, you know, I guess if you want to add 20 more words to the statute, you can go ahead and do that, but I don't see, I mean, yeah, I guess for the sake of all agreeing, we could just agree, and that provides some consensus for moving on to other things, but I don't really think we've actually accomplished anything other than eating up 40 minutes of time. More specifically on the input, I think, you know, what I'd like to see in something like this, and it gets to Representative Greenlick was talking about what was heard when people went out and listened to folks around the state, is that we're getting B and D done pretty well. There's disagreement over whether or not C is all the time being met, but that E is really the crux of the matter. And I wouldn't word it the way that it's worded there because I don't really know, you know, I don't know what equity, exactly how you're going to define that, and all Oregonians. Ultimately, phrased that way, it means everything to everyone. I mean, what I would prefer to see E read at is something like provide fairness to Oregon landowners being asked to sacrifice to meet goals A through D.
And to be rewarded when...
No, I didn't say rewarded, fairness.
But okay. And to be rewarded when they enhance those?
My point being that I think the main complaint is not that we don't all agree with the 19 goals, but I think the building complaint over time has been that a small number of people are asked to make sacrifices for larger goals that everyone gets to enjoy. And so I think you need, if you're going to put something in there that's going to, you know, change the dynamic at all, or to do anything other than just adding words, I think that's what we have to get after. And if you don't, I mean, that was 10 minutes of my choosing to phrase it that way. I mean, we could spend a lot of time phrasing it differently, but I think that's the missing element. And it's been mentioned many times about Senate Bill 100 having that part that there would be, at that point, they referred to it as compensation to landowners affected by the decision, and that never really happened. But, you know, I think you get a lot more universal buy-in to going forward on concepts like these that are the basis for the land use laws if you have that missing element. I mean, I just think we keep circling around that problem, which is that when the community wants something, it has to have a price. If it's coming at the expense of somebody else. And I'll leave it at that.
I think that's actually a really valid point. I mean, what if we rephrased that or added an additional principle that talked about how the burdens of our land use system are distributed and borne in an equal, not equal, but in an equitable way.
Burdens and the rewards?
Yeah, the burdens and rewards.
His word is right, actually. His word was fairness. I think that was actually right. Because it factors in, you know, if you're EFU, do you get a property tax exemption? You know, so maybe you're compensated. If you're a, you know, pre-1970 landowner, well, now you got maybe two Measure 49 lots and you sold them for $500,000. And, you know, so maybe you were treated fairly by some actions we've taken. And then maybe you also made a fortune when you got brought right into the UGB.
But for a long time you didn't. So I'm not sure. I think fairness actually is the right word.
Well, except what underlies this discussion, which is an important one, is if society wants to do something and few of the people have to pay the price, they should be compensated. The fact is, empirically, most land use decisions enhance the value of land rather than reduce the value of land. And it used to be, when you didn't have tax laws, that you paid for that by having an increased tax value, so you paid for it in property taxes. So that I doubled the value of your land, your property tax doubled. It doesn't exactly happen that way anymore. So some of that might be both the rewards and the cost. I mean, I think that's where it seems to me fairness comes.
Right. Well, we can debate whether or not that land use, that land gets reevaluated to the extent that you're happy with, or sure. You feel like they. But I mean, the fact of the matter is, to some extent, or to a total extent, when you do benefit from a land use decision, you also end up contributing because your taxes go up.
That's
so
exactly.
You don't hear a lot of complaint from people who get a land use decision that works in their favor, even though they end up having to pay a little bit more, they're also rewarded more. Where the complaints come is when the land use decision is going the other way, where it's devaluing somebody's land, but their taxes aren't changing.
Or where it's not valuing it the way they'd like to see it valued if they had a different decision.
Or they're prevented from doing something that they thought that they had the ability to do. You know, they made investments, they made decisions, and then, you know, the community comes along and makes the decision to just take that away from them without any compensation. That's inherently unfair. I think it's what's driven the complaints and the concerns about the system from the beginning. And again, I think, as was said in before, we can all agree on the positive goals, that what we would like the land use system to do on a positive sense, but I think that, as Representative Clem was pointing out, you know, that sometimes, or a great deal of the time, that comes at the expense of just some people. And there has to be some allowance in the system you're creating for compensating those people, or being fair to them, or whatever term you want to use, but the point is that people just shouldn't be able to have whatever they want at the expense of somebody else. Right? Democracy has to be more than two wolves and a sheep voting on what to have for dinner.
And I think fairness is actually, I think fairness is the right word. I think it's one of the reasons I felt good about Measure 49 staying in effect prospectively. I mean, change the lot of record laws. Well, there are people who already have, they're going to file a Measure 49 claim and they'll be completely compensated. Well, they'll be waived.
And that's great. I think the problem we have left on the table is how to deal with people retroactively that should have that same fairness.
Still didn't file, though, a 37 or 49 claim because we kind of covered.
Okay, but where are those claims?
I mean, well, they'll be done in a year, and I'm going to work on bills here.
Have a word on that?
Yeah, I do all the time. I've
heard that they're going to be done in a year.
That'll
everybody's 49.
That'll be on our committee agenda.
Yeah, no, we will.
Absolutely.
I mean, genuinely.
We've got to get them done.
Yes.
And ways.
Yeah. But if the system creates, as Representative Greenlick points out, inequitable beneficiaries,
Dividends.
And I think it does. I think there's plenty of evidence that it does. And the system also creates those who bear an inequitable burden, as Representative Wingert points out, should the principle be that decisions should try to address both of those? Because I would have a hard time saying we're going to address one part of that equation but not the other, because I think that fundamentally smacks of unfairness. From my point of view.
That's
and is that the way we want to read line D? And I would actually agree with you, Representative Wingert. I think all Oregonians is an impossible hurdle. But Oregon,
from what I've heard,
owners, property users.
This is about land use, so ultimately it's about property.
The problem may not be with the word fairness, the phrase fairness and equity, so much as it is with the phrase all Oregonians. Your point, if I understand you correctly, is that that can be used to justify virtually anything. The problem is disparate treatment, the burdens being borne unequally,
and dealing with that in a way that compensates people and treats them fairly. And I agree with that concept. And I, you know, elsewhere in the bill we have, and I know that Representative Clem is working hard on introducing more mechanisms for compensation like TDRs, and I think that's an avenue we really ought to pursue.
And well, TDRs are one way to do it.
One way to do it, just one way to
but
do it.
But if the system creates a benefit that accrues to a small segment of property owners.
Windfalls and wipeouts, McCall called them, right? Windfalls and wipeouts, givings and takings.
Givings
basically.
And takings.
Well, but his, I liked his point E. It said landowners should get fairness, which also means if they get a windfall, I mean, that fit in what he, I think we, I know he was 10 minutes, we're now like 20 minutes on it, but I actually think the words he said were probably right. It said landowners should get fairness. It didn't assume they should get compensation or taxed more because they got a giving. It just said fairness. And if we could just sort of revisit, I like it.
Imagine a decision, I mean, a system that says we're going to make a land use decision and there's going to be a pot of good that's been created by that, and that pot of good is valued at a certain amount. And then you took that pot of good and distributed it among winners and losers in some way. I mean, as a theoretical model, so the people who lost by that got some of that good, got some of that value. The people who gained gave up a little of the good that they gained in a way that could, I mean, that's one definition of equity. I mean, that's a theoretical model. I don't know how you could actually operationalize that model.
That's
but
the TDR
I think
bill.
That is what you're suggesting.
I think one thing that we're assuming in all of that, though, is that everyone who comes to the benefit side of that equation chooses to cash in on that. Simply put, they may not.
It's a potential value that they have.
Oh, right. But what I hear in the scenario that's, you know, we're kicking around is you're assuming everyone decides because I own land, it got annexed into a boundary that makes my land more popular or profitable. I'm going to put the burden of extra cost on you because your land's now more valuable. What if I just intend to keep the beauty of my land and I'm not cashing in?
Well,
so
what if
you throw quite a variable deal. I mean, under that, what I heard is in that discussion, you're just making the assumption that because everybody had an increase in value, they're going to cash in.
I wouldn't make that assumption.
Maybe the fairness comes about, Representative, at the moment when that property cashes in. Because you don't want to create a situation where property owner has to cash in their farmland or their forest land in order to cover a current cost. But if that property owner didn't do anything to create value, but the rest of the community did, then at some point when that value is realized, what Representative Greenwich is saying is a portion of that should be used to compensate the folks that Representative Wingert is concerned about.
In our TDR work group, we actually had this conversation at first. Our poor Sean's going to get hives just talking about it. But the Stacy somebody plan, I forget, that got dropped at the first meeting because it included the term windfall profits tax. It was triggered only when someone who had come into a UGB decided to convert it to housing use. And then we were going to use it potentially to finance some goodies for purchase of development rights for people who wanted to sign permanent conservation easements. We dropped it because there had the word tax in there. So it was a meeting, but his point is completely valid. And yours is to trigger. The trigger is when they actually realize it, and if they don't, and in fact, we should be incenting them in some cases not to. Estate tax relief, we did it. TDRs, we can do it. So I'm on board.
I'd like to go back in time 20 minutes and not have said anything.
You can't put it back in the bottle.
Yeah, we're still on the principle.
Because my point is about people who were being disproportionately hurt by the system. I was not suggesting a new set of taxes. I want to be that very clear on the record.
Do you have another source of revenue, Representative? Do you have another source of revenue in mind?
Well, I don't think it necessarily, I don't think the answer necessarily is revenue. It could be. My point was simply that in a system in which people are asked to go ahead and do a wish list of what they want, and the people who make the wish list don't have to, if there's no cost to them, you're going to have a very long wish list. And there isn't going to be any prioritization, and a lot of people are going to get steamrolled in that process. My point simply was that by recognizing that it's coming as a, at a cost to somebody, and therefore putting a price on it, you know, a general term, price on it, that forces the people with the wants to make priority decisions and to not necessarily make a list a mile long of all the things they want. You know, it's the difference between me taking you to Safeway and saying, have whatever you want, or saying, here's $100, go into Safeway. Now you're going to make careful decisions and prioritize what it is that you really want. And that's the thing this system never did.
I don't mind putting a price on it as long as somebody else pays it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think the issue that they had in our committee, we then went to what could we do in the UGB, and this is what Chandler said at the very first meeting, we need to take him up on, what could we do there? It's not revenue. It's just what can we do there to make it more efficient, more valuable? What can we do to enhance home builders in the UGB or commercial or anybody else? What can we do there that produces enough goodies that it's worth it to go out and purchase a conservation easement with those goodies? But it's got, the goodies have to be voluntary on both sides. They have to say, yeah, that extra fourth story on a tower, or four floors on a tower, we were never going to be able to do because the neighbors complained we were going to block their view. Now we do it, but the money from that extra towers, we're willing to give apart to go buy some farmland outside of town. I mean, that actually happens in Salem. We knock them down four floors because the neighbors are upset, and the city council says, "Oh boy, that's awful." But you know, what do I lose? We just lowered it down four floors. It wasn't for public safety; it was just outcry. But if they got to go back up four floors and the money went to go buy a bunch of conservation easements voluntarily for growers who want to keep their farms right around the edge of town, well, now you got something to tell the neighbors when you're a city councilor. Look, we want density. You can't complain about 11 stories instead of 7. We got to have density, or we're going to sprawl into the farmland. And if you know, the home builders and these folks say, yeah, that's of an actual value to us and we'd be willing to pay more to get that four floors back, and it buys a farm permanent conservation easement, that's the whole TDR concept right there.
That's not exactly voluntary.
On both sides, they can both say no.
Okay, I'd like to jump in here. You guys...
You didn't get it back.
...are getting, I think, getting us into some of the specific kinds of challenges that lead us into a perception that land use in Oregon doesn't work. The truth is that the majority of the decisions, most of land use planning in this state has really worked quite well. You can always find examples of differences of opinions in what's a value to this, in one sense, may not be a value in another sense. As I listen to the conversation, I really think that you could leave in the concept of fairness and equality, but take out the verbiage to all Oregonians, because that is a benchmark that you will never meet. There is no land use decision, and admittedly, by the time that either Representative Esquivel or I saw a lot of the land use decisions, they were ones that were very controversial. There were a whole bunch of other things that were decided under the basic principles of how we want our communities to grow or expand or do these things that were decisions that were just made, and they were accepted, and people in general agreed with them. If I've been enjoying a view of the ocean for the last 10 years, and there's a guiding principle that says you can't build in that little stretch closer to the ocean from me, and you challenge it and you get to build your three-story house, and now I don't have a view. You know, there's value, you've owned that land and now you get to build on it. I have value in what I thought I had, and I have now had it. There's always going to be inherent conflicts in some of the decisions that we make, and I don't think that we want to go down that road of trying to place a specific value and award it in one way or another. There may be some exceptions to that, what I've just said, in terms of transferable rights, or maybe even there are some areas that we can explore compensation opportunities. But if you're getting into guiding principles, I don't think you want to get really specific and then start talking about language on whose burden it is and how we're going to award that. I think then you would be getting into some specific kinds of stuff that would find you litigating everything as around that kind of verbiage and that much specificity. You know what I mean.
We should probably move to our next section that actually does have some teeth.
I do want to follow up a little bit with what Representative Cowan is saying. When it comes to growth, we really, I don't see where we are, and I've heard the term gobbling up our agricultural land. At least I don't see that in rural Oregon where I live too much. Yeah, you get an orchard now and then, but it may be an old orchard with a bad class of soil. But what we've learned is when you get up next to an agricultural land, there's two things that I think you have to be conscious of. One is that in your urban growth boundary, your city should approve all structures within that urban growth boundary because it'll eventually come into the city and it has to meet city criteria. Also, you have to have a memorandum of understanding between the county and the city that they don't build into the UGB and then go through the county, and the SDCs go into the county coffers instead of the city coffers, which in turn the city ends up getting the piece of property into the city itself. If you have, and we're going to go on to another issue here, and that's the
that
annexation.
That moves you rather nicely to section C.
You've kind of jumped us into the very next item of discussion, so let's go there.
So going into the annexation process, there's so many ways that you can annex. It's unbelievable in this state. We've never had a kick with annexation in Medford. You've never read about it?
You've never heard about it? I think 17 different ways.
Yeah, I think it's 17 different ways to do that, and I think you're correct. But we do a application annex where you apply and ask to come into the city. No one forces you, except once every 10 years we go through and clean up all the island annexations and do an island annexation because the city has grown around one little quarter-acre lot or something of that nature. And we will annex that way, and that's the only forced annexation we have. So the way 17's worded, I'm going to have some real, real problems with 17.
I'm happy to comment. I really do think, as I say, there are, I think, 17 different ways of two different sets of statutes that annexation can take place. I think we did some things to improve the discussion on it in the last session. It seems to me this is an omnibus thing that simply says anytime a city annexes, increases its urban growth boundary, it needs to annex everything in its urban growth boundary. It is a very blunt instrument. I have a real problem with that.
I would adopt the League of Oregon Cities recommendation. Additional legislative or interim work group vetting is needed.
We had testimony also from, I think it was a gentleman from Eugene, an annexation association, and I don't know if he has statewide members, that suggested if we move forward with this, recognizing the distinction between a property that is already developed to arguably an urban density, and that would have to be left to some people to define,
and then also recognizing sections of the state where there are local ordinances around voting procedures.
Jerry Ritter, OCVA.
Right.
But I think it was in writing. I have it, but I think it was something verbal that was said.
I would agree with Representative Greenlick that this is a blunt instrument, although I would also suggest that, to some extent, this question really comes up under the infrastructure section. How you provide infrastructure physically and how you provide the financial wherewithal to service areas. And if you don't deal with that,
absolutely,
then you have real groundwater problems.
Absolutely.
And road congestion problems and school overcrowding or school cost problems and all kinds of things. And I'm not, I don't know if you do it under annexation or if you do it under infrastructure.
Yeah, Metro Annex added Bethany to the urban growth boundary with the requirement, it turned out later, that it needed $250 million in infrastructure that was never considered as a part of the annexation. I mean, that stuff shouldn't happen. That's just...
So, in other words, they weren't upgrading larger before they got out to that area.
Yeah.
So then they had to go back and redo in order to
they don't know what to
complement
do
that?
I mean, they literally don't know what to do now because they got to come up with $250 million, and nobody can figure out who's going to pay for it. So they're sitting with 800 acres that were intended to be residential land, but they can't get
the infrastructure,
the streets to it. They can't get the sewers. I mean, it's absurd.
Before they annex someone who's already there, they increase the taxes 40% to 70%, often with no vote, no public hearing. Then you don't get like sidewalks and street lamps ever. So you have city tax rates, but you don't get the infrastructure. I've got a bill that would say within 3 years you need to furnish them the services. Then, if you're going to annex them, they're going to be part of the city, then do the sidewalks. But they say we don't have the money to do that. So the way annexation usually occurs is bare ground, you know, in some places, bare ground annexation, voluntary, that's what the developer wants. They have to pay for it all. Then they maybe get tax credits to start getting paid back over time. And then citizens say, wow, should I be paying through tax credits at least to finance this new area out there with brand new street sidewalks, street lights? I got huge potholes in front of my house. I don't want to pay for that. Now I want to vote on it. So now we have charter amendments all over the place because they, yeah, I mean, it's one that could use more betting would be my argument.
Anybody a big fan of Section 17?
No.
Does anyone remotely like 17? I guess that would be the better question.
I like your question. Produce more consensus.
16 and 17, I think, certainly separated from 15, are difficult to support. They're not separated. I mean, the bill includes a way of addressing infrastructure. Although that creates all kinds of opportunities for discussion, too, because under 15, and I'm jumping ahead on your schedule, I'm sorry, and maybe I'm arguing for, at a minimum, deferring this until we dig into infrastructure. But my sense is there is, since the legislature has dealt over the last two sessions with annexation issues, there is a question on committee as to whether now is the time to further delve into that particular part of land use law, and that I'm not hearing anyone say that the purpose of a big look bill rests on including a section on annexation.
I agree, but I'm not opposed to Representative Clem's suggestion of an amendment that would set up an interim work group as suggested by the League of Oregon Cities to look at this.
Okay.
There was a work group and they had 39 consensus points. We should just read the report probably and then look at it in another bill later, maybe next session. I mean,
yeah, I don't think this is an issue right now. I mean, yeah. I think it's settled down.
It's always an issue.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's I don't think it's appropriate for what this bill is trying to do. And because you really have to divide it into two different discussions. One is your very valid point about adequate infrastructure expansion if you're going to bring areas into an urban environment, whether that's within the urban growth boundary or within the city. But the reality of what's on the ground in the state of Oregon is that we have a lot of historical kinds of changes that have been made that likely aren't particularly appropriate, but fixing those by the blunt instrument of annexation is also very problematic and causes all sorts of anxiety. Sometimes, as one area that I have in my district, is frankly very poor decision making that was made many, many years ago, thankfully well before my time, about extending a certain amount of services. But then once people have them, why should they annex, for pity's sake? Why should they increase their taxes by 70% when they have the basic service that they need without perhaps all of the extras? So you've got different...
Good question. Why should they?
Hmm?
That's a good question. Why should they?
Well,
I mean, if they got the basic services, why
they've got
they?
The basic...
Guiding principle D.
They, actually, what they have is the basic service of water and, I think, sewer. The contract, the 25-year contract for the provision of that water was actually expiring. And what they don't have is city-level police protection and sidewalks and parking ordinances and a variety of things that they then demand of county government to provide city-level service, but they don't want to annex. It, what I'm saying is there's two issues. One is around orderly expansion and providing for that infrastructure.
Absolutely. That's
the other question. Is a very difficult issue to get into about how should you, whether you call it right wrongs or deal with existing challenging situations.
See, I wouldn't have a problem if that said that no city should add territory to its urban growth boundary unless it was prepared to provide the services that are needed. Unless it was prepared to assure urban level services. I don't have a problem with that. But this simply says you expand your urban growth boundary, you annex them. There's no requirement of providing services that goes with that. It's odd.
Well, see, and the other point is that if we had an opportunity, I believe that we're required as a municipality to have a 20-year supply of residential.
A buildable supply.
Of buildable land, whereas if we had a 30 or a 40, what we try to do is we'll oversize these components of your infrastructure as we go out. Example, you may only need a 12-inch line, but we say, okay, but we want you to put in a 36-inch line. Because we know in the future there's going to be people out there. And that gives you an opportunity to plan of where you go. The way it is now, if you do 20 years, you're up again doing this later, another 10 years, you're working down with your urban growth boundary again, and it may or may not go that way. So it's a vicious circle, it really is.
That's the whole urban rural reserve theory.
Yep.
Go 50 years out, figure out where you're likely going to go, then you can figure out how to do it. Now, who was on the committee that made it up? I mean, a big debate, so I'm not going to get into it. But yeah, that's a lot of work groups, a lot of stuff's already been done around a lot of this, actually. We probably should just collect them all and think about it for another bill.
That may be, although I actually heard something from Representative Greenlick that I'm going to ask him to write up and see if it makes sense for us to think about. If you wouldn't mind.
Happy to.
Thanks.
I think I've got the part done, if you want, that deals with already urbanized.
Get the easy part, complexity.
I'm not talking about already urbanized. I think all this says is, this is a future statement. City annexes, if a city expands its urban growth boundary, that land can be annexed. It's only talking about future. It's not talking about the mess that we have now. So I would simply say a city may not expand its urban growth boundary until it's prepared to provide urban services to
that
the
would have
territory.
Addressed the Bethany situation.
Yeah.
You could steal the bill. I'm not going to get anywhere with it anyway. It basically says the city annexes, it must provide X number or a certain percentage of the services within a certain amount of time. You can steal it and take it, bring it over here and change it to that.
You two talk.
Send it over.
Yeah.
Right. I just lost the bill.
We'll do it together.
You want in on this too, Representative Wingert? You want to work with them on that?
I'm against annexes.
You've got Bull Mountain.
I was going to say, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You've got it.
I have it here somewhere.
Easy
I am
there.
Against annexation.
Okay.
I maybe take my no forced annexation sign off the door because it looked like a frat house around here, Betsy Johnson said.
Last one, easy softball for the afternoon. auditing and
Section
reducing
18.
complexity.
Reduce redundant complexity.
I think
only keep essential complexity.
I think so, certainly.
We have to do something.
It's going to cost money, I know, or something. I'm not sure, but yes.
Costs money, but if you do it right, it ends up reducing lots of costs. But it's that initial time that it takes to plow through, and
it can't be done well without some expenditure of money, so that there are the tools in place to do it well.
You're right.
I like the idea. I'm sorry. I'm confused by Section 18 as it's currently written. It talks about a work group doing a policy-neutral review and audit. Later in that paragraph, though, it talks about, in terms that are really policy-oriented terms, about deciding what types of, basically how we can do this to allow for greater variation between regions of the state. Mm-hmm. That's a policy goal. Reducing complexity, I think, is policy neutral. So one thing we should discuss, I think, is whether we want to do either or both. But there are two different ideas embedded in that paragraph, I think.
Not really. If you look to the concept of a policy neutral review, and then it goes back to the fact that the commission would make those policy decisions based on that review.
I see what you're saying.
I read this section and thought we could have replaced the words work group with Big Look Task Force. I mean, it looked to me like we were doing it all over again. I mean, when I read it and it ended in reduced complexity, I thought, is the record stuck? Because it seems like we were doing the same thing over again to me. And, you know, while I applaud the idea that, you know, and I could go back to what the task force said, reduce complexity, more flexibility, all of those things, in my mind, this is yet another review.
I guess that I would respond to that by saying one thing I have heard is that and it's not so much the complexity as it is internal contradictions within the system. And I don't think we ever gave Big Look the mandate or the resources to do a legal analysis of the land use planning system to try and identify internal contradictions. But I do think that would be worth doing.
If you look at the Big Look Task Force report, because that's the way I took it, was a more internal review. The Big Look effort was a statewide, bring everybody in, have them give testimony on opinions about land use planning. This recommendation seems to get to the fact that many citizens believe that our land use system is unnecessarily complex, limiting their ability to be involved in the decision making. So I see this as a directive for an internal look at the administrative rules that are in place and where how those fit together, rather than any kind of a duplication of the go out and conduct hearings all over the state sort of effort. If that's not the intention, then we probably need to talk about whether we're recreating the same effort again.
Is there an inherent conflict between the notions of flexibility and fairness and equity lumped together and simplicity?
Probably.
I have to think. I mean, my interpretation of the regular additions to the land use statutes in the state is that people who sat in our chairs 30 years ago, 25 years ago, thought they found
something that was, pick it, unfair or inequitable or too expensive in the way it was written before, and so they added something. And of course, standing alone, that probably made a lot of sense. But then when you start to accumulate 30 years worth of that, how do you ever get to the point where you can clear the cobwebs out? And I think this is really about clearing the cobwebs out, isn't it? But do you lose something when you clear the cobwebs out?
I think this is what you see with the tax code. I mean, you could have a flat tax. We could do away with the entire federal tax code tomorrow and go with a flat tax. And then if you come back 30 years later, the book's going to be this thick because the legislative bodies immediately go to work saying, well, that flat tax isn't right for this guy over here. We're going to carve out an exception for him and this group over there. And, you just restart the process. So it's really what this is, whether or not every now and again you want to put the reset button, press the reset button and then start the process right over again. But you'll still have a rush of lobbyists here in this building to create carve-outs again for people.
Zero-based budgeting.
Yeah, what I would do is... I would ask the main users of the land use system what cities they've had really great luck with mayors who figured out how to make the one-stop shopping go, make the permits go, figure out how to do it. Because there's a lot of good work being done around the state. And I'm sure there's some horror stories. I don't know. But that's, I think, where we could get some... because it's essentially you go through it and you... find things that can be done that don't gut the intent. They don't change the intent. They just make it easier for people to do it. And I'm sure we've got mayors who've done it in their cities. I'm sure.
To kind of give you an idea of how that works, we have a community right next. We have Medford and Center Point. And there was an annexation process in Central Point that I overheard, and they were talking about, they asked them how long it takes. And the response from the individual Central Point was, this one may be a little longer. It may take 2 months. Well, in Medford, we had layered that thing to the point of where it took 8 to 14 months. So I went into Medford and started asking questions. Why do we do this? Why do we do that? Well, the first question I asked, why do we do this? And the individual said, well, I don't know. We've always done it that way.
Same state statute governing both.
Exactly.
Yeah,
same state of Oregon.
Yeah.
And then the second thing I went and said, why do we do this? Because, it's a time frame, every one of these. And the individual grinned at me and said, I'll tell you what, let me work on this and get back with you. I was on the city council at the time. And that individual came back by just lopping off things that they didn't even know why they did it. Cut the time in half, which still isn't good enough, but still, that's a pretty substantial gain. And that's what I think maybe we have a tendency to do with our land use. We do a certain instance, we add in a layer or some kind of a time frame, and then we do another time frame and another time frame.
But they didn't take away public hearings. I mean, they didn't take away the things
they didn't take
we
away
all
the basics.
Hold dear in our values. Right. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
There are places in our land use laws that are really no left turn only. I mean, you really, you get around them by pretending they're not what they say they are. I mean, if we can move some...
Careful, 30 years from now, people will be saying the same things about the legislation.
Well, and I'll be carrying a bill on the floor tomorrow, on Tuesday, trying to clean up something if we could move anything forward that would get an intelligent look at the complexity in the system... and find simple ways to reduce it. I mean, I was only kidding when I said a zero-based budgeting, but the fact is, I really like zero-based budgeting if it comes on once every 10 years or every 20 years, because some way you have to go back to those first principles.
What are the basics?
Again, yeah. I think this would be
perhaps,
so valuable.
Perhaps a net zero, and I don't know how you'd craft it.
Net minus 20.
Well, or net minus whatever. The problem is you can't put shackles on a future legislature. But the notion of, if you want to change the land use laws, your net impact, if you want to add something that's a difference or a qualifier,
a complexity impact
you have statement. To, oh, well, something like that. Or you have to take off something.
I think that's the very reason that this suggestion makes some sense.
Yeah.
It's not unique to what we do anyplace else in the statute. When we see a problem, we write a new bill to try to fix a piece of statute, and pretty soon that's why it takes us however many books it does to print Oregon statute. I really think this is a spot where we could spend a moment thinking about what the Big Look report said. With each passing year, new requirements and exemptions have been added to the state land use systems through legislative action as well as administrative rulemaking. The end result is a land use system of growing complexity that produces tremendous benefits but is weighed down by the years of complex amendments and cross-references that make the system unapproachable for many citizens. And then there was a side note, it says some groups see the audit as a tool to potentially offer more flexibility within the state's land use system by identifying and eliminating unnecessary steps in detail. And I really think that Representative Clem had a point when he talked about going back to the, I say localities, not just the cities, because I believe some counties are also finding effective ways, but to back to the localities to look at where the system works well and how they do it, in addition to some internal look at what the system's complexities are.
Representative Cowan, may I ask you a question? And I'm going to speak from one...
I don't know, it's up to the chair.
Don't you. From one county to the other county here. Does the people in your county feel that the land use laws are very, very layered, very expensive, and very time-consuming to get anything done? Because that is my county feels that way.
The testimony that my county planner offered to this committee was that they believe that essentially the land use law is working fairly well. They see some pieces where there could be some exceptions that would make it easier to meet our needs. And frankly, as a local decision maker, I fell back on the law when people were trying to do things that you could put forth a reasonable argument, but really, in the big picture, it might not have been the best choice. There were other times that I didn't think the law met the needs of what would be logical to do. So, yes, yeah, sometimes. Other times, not so much.
Other times we use it as a guiding light.
But it's that way with anything. There's always going to be moments when this isn't the way. And I am not here to defend every piece of the land use system. But I think the idea of looking at how does this rule affect that rule affect that rule would be a pretty worthwhile effort.
And Representative Wingert raises a good point that it is very much the same thing with the tax code. Colleagues, it is very much the same thing with virtually every book in the ORS. That we started out with one or two books that constituted Oregon revised statutes, and the revised has now turned them into, I don't know how many books we've got on our shelves, folks, 20. We do have a mechanism that could be a model, maybe even an implementing tool to address this. First premise I would offer the committee is it took us 35 years to get here. Maybe we shouldn't be aiming to undo 35 years instantly. Maybe it should take us 3 or 4 or 5 years to systematically go through and do some cleanup. We heard on the floor today a bill that did a certain amount of cleanup out of the Revenue Committee. Some conflicts or unclear pieces, not changing the intent, but trying to clear things up. Now, I'm hearing some of the conversation here be, maybe we wouldn't want to limit it to not changing intent, but to bringing forward apparent conflicts or apparent outdated things or aspects of our law that create hindrances to the four guiding principles.
And sometimes it's ambiguity that does
sometimes,
that.
Sometimes, yes.
I'm intrigued with, I think Portland and Multnomah County made things a lot easier by having one door to go to for a land use question. I mean, before you had to figure out, is it Multnomah County, is it Portland, where do you go? There's not one place, you don't have to ask. Now that simple thing made I think made a lot of people's life a lot easier.
So ELSI should help us do this. The department could help us do this. Both of them are pretty much up to their eyeballs now. The Law Commission exists in some ways to address ambiguities, unclarity, that kind of thing in the law. I actually talked with Representative Shetterly, who chairs the Law Commission now and who might be someone who, because of his other background, could be very helpful in this. He didn't jump at the opportunity, but he said, you know, maybe there's some merit here.
Madam Chair, I sat on a work group for the Law Commission on liability issues, and the more we talked, the more complex everything got. I hope you're right.
One way of perhaps addressing this. Because the other point you raised, Representative Cowan, is we shouldn't fool ourselves. If we really want a thoughtful effort put to this audit, it is something that we will have to invest some resources in, some professional, objective time. And that doesn't happen for free.
And I don't want to sidetrack the department at a time when there are some other things they really need to
get. I second that. I agree. I think it has other priorities that Absolutely. It should be paying attention to, that we've asked it to. But is it worth pursuing? Representative Garrett has also done some outreach to see if there's a possibility there. Thoughts?
I heard a couple of things. I mean, one was about how localities are interpreting the rules, and it's coming out different. I mean, just the time frame and the steps are coming out differently in different communities, and I certainly would add my voice to, I don't know exactly how you go about trying to share best practices from community to community, other than motivated county commissioners, city council members who go and visit another place and come back and say, why can't we do that here? But I think from the policy, and because I know that the other thing that's been mentioned before, that something Representative Clem has expressed concern about, is the growing number of exemptions that exist in the law. And I think that's really a policy question. And from my point of view, I think if you were going to have a task force or a group look, I think what you want to, the question you want to have answered is, as the law is currently constructed, people felt they needed these exemptions. Assume for the sake of argument that the exemptions were basically a good idea because previous legislatures passed them. What was it about the law as written that didn't allow for those things, that wasn't flexible enough to allow those? And is there a way to change that to not only permit those but maybe some other as yet the exemptions that are going to be coming at us this time or in the next legislative session, next one. I mean, can the task force identify what it is about those exemptions that might unify them or some similarities that, but I think at the end of the day, you're talking about taking that law and making it more flexible in some way, because clearly it was inflexible in that it didn't permit those exemptions that a majority of legislators believe it should. But that's clearly a policy question, because it's not something that can be policy neutral. I mean, ultimately,
I'd be willing to bet that sometimes it was that a majority of legislators thought the law was not flexible enough, and that sometimes it was because a majority of the legislature thought it was too flexible. I bet you've got both of those going on in there.
The Law Commission is probably not the best suited group to do a policy-based mm-hmm. analysis of this. I think their expertise would be well suited to examining the code and the rules for internal inconsistencies, redundancy, unneeded complexity, and trying to really, I think the phrase cleaning out the cobwebs is right. I would urge that there's merit to this, but I think to make it worthwhile and to make it feasible for them, if we delegate it to them, we have to really put sideboards on that exclude policy analysis of the code.
Mm-hmm. One other thing we will need to talk about as we go through this committee's work is we will probably identify several things that cost money that we want done. Cleaning this up will cost some money. I think, and I suspect all of you do, that if we do that, it will actually save money, not only public money, but more importantly, applicants' money and property owners' money in order to make beneficial use of their land. But it does take that kind of priming the pump. And we'll have to figure out, first of all, if we're going to be able to advance any of those to the Ways and Means Committee this session. And if we can, we'll have to prioritize them. Because if we send them down without priority, you know, preference for where we think things are most important, I don't think they'll make the best decisions. I'm hearing the committee say that number one priority is processing of Measure 49 claims.
I think ultimately we can spend a lot of time on this, but we probably all need to give some thought as to whether the efforts of we put into any legislation that comes out of this committee, where will that fall in the priority of things we need to do within the constraints of this fiscal, the fiscal challenges we're facing.
Okay. We still have a little bit more time, but it looks like the committee's running out of steam.
Did you see that?
Okay. What?
Recap.
Representative?
I'll try. I think we had agreement on this, on the statement of principles, with possibly the exception of wanting to refine the fourth one. We don't believe annexation, Section 16 and 17 of the bill, really belong in this vehicle.
Except Representative Greenlick is going to take
except that Representatives Greenlick and Clem have an idea that they're going to be talking about. And on Section 18, I heard a consensus in favor of doing a review for redundancy, complexity, internal inconsistency, dysfunctionality. And there's interest in pursuing the Law Commission.
Subject to cost.
Right.
Representative Garrett, I was not a consensus on that. I
didn't hear you speak at all on that.
So. No. I said, to me, it was the appointment of one more task force. I was not in favor of that.
So your preference would be that this not be, this concept not be part of the final product?
Yes.
For Tuesday, next Tuesday, let's see if we can make some valuable contributions, head our chief drafter, not drafter, but coordinator, in a good direction on sections 9 through 12. Okay.
I would like to ask the vice chair a question. You're an attorney.
I'd like to ask this vice chair to help on this because you've got experience, particularly around the regional problem solving.
That would be great. I think we're going to discuss this. My question is, and it's probably a very stupid question, but I guess the only stupid question is one that's not asked. If you have A, B, C, and D the way it is now, and I'm thinking here, okay, if I have a piece of property in Jackson County that is zoned industrial, I bring in a business that has 7.5-ton particulate level per year, but Jackson County and we in the region have agreed to and voluntarily put a 5-ton particulate limit in the region, but the rest of the state of Oregon is 15, which it is. Could they sue us?
On the basis of the four principles?
Well, let's get back to fairness and equality to all Oregonians.
and decided that language wasn't going to last.
Well, equality and fairness, let's say.
Well, my legal analysis would be no. I don't think these four principles provide any right of action.
Okay.
But that's one man's opinion, so.
Then if there's 10 of you, we have 15 different opinions, right?
Well, if you paid him, you'd get a different opinion.
So our two vice chairs will work together to help walk us through a discussion on regional problem solving.
I'm familiar with
some good
with
ideas
it, ma'am.
Bringing brought forward.
Madam Chair, I've had it for 9 years.
Good. Sections 9 through 12. This could be a 15-minute meeting because you'll bring us the answer and we'll be done.
Okay, I'm going to plan that in my calendar. 15 minutes.
I heard we're within the ballpark of finishing.
Yes, we are. Yeah.
As soon as you left the room, the work just sped up.
Yeah, I mean, we started accomplishing all this.
We're adjourned.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I just thought
about that bill to make sure.